The Fourth District Appellate Court of the State of Illinois has now convened. The Honorable Robert J. Steigman presiding.
Good afternoon, counsel. This is our case number 4-22-0797, People of the State of Illinois versus Dustin A. Finlaw. For counsel for the appellant, please state your name.
Sarah Lucy, Your Honor.
Thank you. And counsel for the appellee, please state your name.
Can't hear you. Good, Your Honor.
Okay, good. Okay, Ms. Lucy, you may proceed on behalf of the appellant.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good afternoon, and may it please the court, counsel. My name is Sarah Lucy from the Office of the State Appellate Defender, and I represent the appellant, Dustin Finlaw. In this case, the trial court erred twice, both times by misunderstanding the standard that applied at the hearing that was being held. First, at the restoration hearing, the trial court determined that it could not rule out that Dustin was fit, rather than ruling out the possibility that he was unfit. Then, at his motion hearing to go pro se, the trial court believed that it was bound by Dustin's request to proceed pro se, rather than indulging in every reasonable presumption against the waiver of counsel. To the first error, the trial court failed to have a proper restoration hearing when it held that Dustin was restored to competency because it did not know that Dustin could prove that he was no longer hearing voices. One problem with this is that Dustin testified incorrectly, demonstrably falsely, at his fitness hearing, saying that he believed that he was misdiagnosed with schizophrenia and denying that he had ever heard voices, aside from a brief instance in 2018 where he claimed that he was sleep deprived.
Well, I'm not sure I understand your question or your comment, counsel. Were you talking about how the court was saying it wasn't sure or didn't see how the defendant could establish that he was no longer hearing voices?
Yes, Your Honor. That was basically the sum total of the reasoning that the trial court gave in this situation.
Well, but whether he hears voices or not isn't directly connected at all, is it, to his fitness to stand trial and the criteria governing that?
It doesn't have to be, Your Honor. In this case, it is. In this case, the problem that all the parties agreed upon was whether or not Dustin would be able to assist in his defense when he told Dr. Killian that he would always listen to Seraphine rather than his own defense attorney. So while Dr. Killian gave the example that Dustin could believe that he owned all the BMWs in Jacksonville and that wouldn't be a problem, or he could make the conscientious decision to listen to his brother rather than listen to his attorney, those weren't the circumstances that we were worried about in this case.
Well, why not? As a matter of fact, you're before a panel of experienced trial judges who have dealt with lots of lawyers and defendants in similar cases where lawyers complain the defendant doesn't believe me or want to go along with me. He's listening to mama or his girlfriend or his brother or someone else. Is that a sign that he's not fit to stand trial if he rejects his lawyer's advice because of what he hears from some other source?
Deciding to listen to another source over your own attorney may be a bad idea, but when it doesn't stem from a mental condition, it's your conscious choice. It's that defendant's choice.
My question, counsel, was that a function of lack of fitness to stand trial that a defendant chooses to disregard his lawyer's advice, possibly listening to counsel of others, or just choose to disregard it, period?
When it is a choice, that is not going to be a bar towards fitness. When it is not a choice, because it is a condition of an
unfit, we're losing you, counsel. We've lost your response.
I beg your pardon. I can, Your Honor. I apologize I don't know why my internet would not be working, except that the Murphy's Law.
Well, mine is unstable.
Your
too.
Honor, I mean, my response to,
go ahead.
Is everyone able to hear me now?
Yes.
Your Honor, going back to my response to your question, here what we have is not Dustin making a conscientious decision. We have him suffering from the ongoing effects of severe schizophrenia for which he is not taking his medication. He has been seeing Seraphine since he was 11 years old and has been following her directive since then.
Well, but we know, counsel, good counsel, excuse me for interrupting, but we know that he testified that he was not hearing voices at the time this hearing, the restoration hearing, was being conducted. We also know that mental illness is a chronic illness and that sometimes the symptoms do come and go. And so he testified, and the trial judge certainly had the discretion to listen and believe that testimony, that at the time, certainly, of the hearing, he was not hearing voices, hearing Seraphine, and or listening to Seraphine.
I think this would have been a very different case if his testimony had been, I was hearing Seraphine in 2018 and 2019 when I told Dr. Killian that I was, when I reported at IDHS that I was, when I was found to be unfit by all these litany of doctors. But now that I'm medication compliant, and if the evidence had supported that he was in fact medication compliant, which he was not, and he simply said, I am no longer hearing voices, that's restored to fitness. That is absolutely not what we see in this case. What we have him is a blanket denial, really, that he's ever heard voices. He says since 2018, I was sleep deprived when I was first arrested, and I was seeing some sort of orbs. And that's it.
I have another question. Other than your concern about his hearing voices from Seraphine, is there anything in this record to demonstrate that the defendant did not understand the nature and purpose of the proceedings against him, or to demonstrate that he was unable to cooperate with counsel?
The problem here is very much the second prong. I believe that all parties below agreed that Dustin is a very intelligent young man and was able to understand the role of the judge, the role of the prosecutor, the charges against him, etc. Defense counsel was concerned from the very first and up until he was dismissed as counsel and transferred into his role as standby counsel. He did not believe that he was properly able to communicate with Dustin, or that Dustin was able to assist in his defense, which is an important problem.
Well, counsel, but that again goes back solely, if I understand your argument, and if I've misunderstood it, correct me, solely to the business about how he's hearing Seraphine and would take Seraphine's advice over counsel's. Isn't that the sole basis?
That is the major concern, and I think it's—
Well, you say major, I said sole. So if I'm mistaken that it's the sole basis, point out what additional grounds you have that the defendant demonstrated didn't understand the nature or purposes of the proceedings against him, or demonstrated an inability to communicate and cooperate with counsel.
I think that would fundamentally go to what he said about keeping secrets from counsel, that he's being directed by others, whether it's Seraphine, the Lamb, or other Grays, about what he should not disclose, what he wanted his defense to be. He's listening to these other sources that are figments of his imagination, rather than being able to be present enough to make these rational decisions. And ultimately, the trial court, who was presented with Dr. Killian's testimony that he did not believe that Dustin was fit to stand trial, never resolved that. The presumption at the fitness hearing was that Dustin was still unfit. It was the burden of the state to prove by a preponderance of the evidence to overcome that unfitness presumption. And that's where we see the wrong standard being applied.
Well, can I interrupt on standards, Ms. Lucy? Because
well, go ahead.
I have a question about the standard of review.
That was going to be a question I had too. Go ahead, Justice.
You and the state seem to agree that it's abuse of discretion. There is Supreme Court authority saying that the decision whether to find somebody fit is one that's reviewed under manifest weight. There are some cases which talk about structural pieces of the process, which might be reviewed under abuse of discretion, such as acting on stipulations without other evidence or rubber stamping a conclusion from an expert. Is it correct that you are not challenging the balance of the evidence here or the sufficiency of the evidence? You are challenging the way in which the trial court conducted the hearing?
I would say that I am challenging both the sufficiency of the state's evidence as well as the way in which the trial court resolved its credibility. I know that I personally put great stock in People v. Gibson, recognizing, of course, that is not a Supreme Court case. However, it was the most akin case, and they considered de novo review, considered manifest weight review, decided that manifest weight was inappropriate in this circumstance because it presumed that the hearing had been proper. And right. So that's why.
So the idea is there are some things that when you fall below a level, that means that the hearing really didn't satisfy our expected minimums. Is that the argument that you're making?
Correct, Your Honor. Here, the fitness hearing did not satisfy due process.
Well, but we do have, this is not like some of the other cases that you've talked about, where the trial court merely relied on a stipulation of the experts that the defendant was fit to stand trial. Here, we have a trial judge who took a very independent and active role. In fact, when Dr. Killian testified at this hearing, he certainly questioned him during the course of the hearing. He considered the reports. He considered the testimony of a nurse. Aren't you really asking us to be the judges of the credibility of the experts and the witnesses the trial judge heard? And certainly that's not our role. I'm sorry, we've just had our phones fixed here. Let me see if I can, I guess it's taken care of. I apologize. Isn't that the role that you are asking this court to assume in this case?
Not necessarily, Your Honor, because here what we have is blatant mistruths, which is sort of where I began my argument, where the trial court is misapplying the standard, having heard Dustin's evidence that was immediately disproven and shown to be false, and then relied, apparently, because he didn't actually state this in the record, but then apparently gave more credence to Dr. Pan's report than Dr. Killian's report. However, it is clear from Dr. Pan's report that by that time, in late 2020, Dustin had become untruthful. Once again, we see in Dustin's interview with Dr. Pan, this denial, this rolling back of what...
But you're saying untruthful as opposed to inconsistent. I mean, those are two different things. What Dustin testified to was something that is subjective, is it not? And perhaps he did say something inconsistent to the two different experts at different times. But we also have Dr. Killian's testimony, do we not, that he was quite surprised by Dustin's ability to be coherent, to conduct himself properly in a courtroom proceeding. And he hadn't seen that when he examined Dustin in 2018 and 2019, did he?
Correct, Your Honor. Absolutely correct. I think that would go to Dr. Killian's later testimony where he said that Dustin is an expert in anti-malingering. He has a vested interest. Please excuse me, Your Honor. He has a vested interest in being perceived as fit. It was very clear that he did not want to return to Chester. He had told Dr. Killian he did not want to return to Chester where he had been attacked, where the medication had given him seizures. So it is very possible, given, as I said earlier, Dustin is an incredibly intelligent young man, that he would be able to comport himself for the length of a hearing as if nothing were the matter, but what we have is at least three doctors, independently of one another, finding that Dustin suffered from schizophrenia. And we have evidence at the hearing that this schizophrenia was not being treated with medication. And even so, we have these, or not even so, but we also have this complete disavowal now from Dustin, not saying I've recovered from hearing voices, but saying, oh, I never heard voices. That really doesn't comport with Dr. Killian, who is a leading forensic psychologist, who at one point in his testimony said that he had examined 1,800 cases. I don't know if that's an accurate number, but to believe that he would have fooled Dr. Killian into believing that he was having such severe schizophrenic symptoms, to say that he fooled IDHS into thinking he was having severe schizophrenic symptoms, and then Dr. Pan's opinion was that he was schizophrenic and suffered from schizophrenia, and then Dustin is saying, oh no, that's not true. None of that never happened.
I have a question on the second issue you raise, and that is this. If the trial court properly found the defendant fit to stand trial, are you asserting that there is some additional requirement that the record must show that the trial court had to inquire about before the court could properly permit this defendant or any defendant in that situation to proceed pro se?
Yes, Your Honor, it is a absolutely bifurcated question. One's fitness to stand trial does not necessarily govern their fitness to waive counsel and proceed pro se, as found by our United States Supreme Court in Indiana v. Edwards.
But Edwards never imposed the second obligation. All Edwards said, if I understand correctly, is that the states were free, if they wished, to impose additional burdens upon the court on the record before permitting a defendant with a mental illness to proceed pro se. But Illinois has never accepted that. And the Illinois Supreme Court, and most recently the Illinois appellate courts, have made clear that Edwards is permissive rather than prescriptive, and a trial court may deny, said the Second District recently, a severely mentally ill person from representing himself, that before that would happen, the trial court does not have to perform any additional inquiries. And under Illinois law, the court could permit this person to do so. Isn't that correct?
Well, Your Honor, in People v. Burton, our Illinois Supreme Court approved of denying a mentally ill, this particular defendant had clinical depression, denying that person the ability to waive counsel and proceed pro se. The First District in People v. Perkins also made the same determination that if someone is fit to stand trial but still suffers from mental defects, it is absolutely permissible for the trial court to deny their motion. But here what we see once again is the incorrect standard, where the trial court says you have the unfettered right. No one is ever going to tell you that you don't have the constitutional right to elect to represent yourself. That is your constitutional right.
Isn't that correct?
No, Your Honor. It is not your absolute constitutional right. It is a constitutional right. However, it is one that our United States Supreme Court has said trial courts must indulge in every presumption against waiver. So that, again, is a very clear edict in Brewster v.
Counsel, that's a very general statement, but in this particular context, hasn't the Supreme Court said that the mental illness really goes into this equation as an additional piece of simply saying, despite the illness, do they understand the waiver? Do they understand what they're waiving? So really, it's not as though there's a higher level of competency needed to represent yourself. There's just maybe an additional question: has the mental illness affected your ability to understand what you need to understand to make that knowing waiver.
And I believe that the record is clear here that Dustin lacked that capacity when in his motion, he was accusing Mr. Piper of forcing him to enter a plea that he didn't want to enter, which is of course one of his fundamental rights and a decision that a trial attorney is not able to override. This goes again, not to beat a dead horse, but back to his ability to assist in his own defense and to communicate with Mr. Piper. And despite the fact that the trial court was able to review this motion, reviewed it on the record, would have seen this discrepancy, the trial court made no further inquiry into Dustin's mental health.
Isn't this pretty much the normal fodder at the time somebody seeks to represent themselves, where they're describing differences in opinions with their attorney about how to handle the case? This is very normal stuff. I think we have to look beyond that to say, did he understand the waiver? And you really haven't argued that he didn't.
Justice Leadoff, you had a question?
Thank you, Justice Steigman. One other brief question. Should we find that the trial court here did not properly conduct this hearing, why wouldn't a retrospective fitness hearing be appropriate or more appropriate than a new trial, which you asked for?
Briefly addressing the questions in order, I will just say that the record here is not clear. The trial court did not make a clear record that Dustin was able and had the capacity to make a knowing and voluntary waiver when his mental health was still unmedicated and seriously in question, given the issues that had happened at the restoration hearing and the fitness hearing. And the reason that the restoration hearing would not be appropriate in this situation is, first of all, it has never been approved of by the Illinois Supreme Court. People v. Neal is still good law, which found that this is only appropriate in psychotropic medication cases where one doctor testifying about the effects of the medication would be appropriate. Appellate courts have taken one sentence from People v. Mitchell. Restoration hearings are now the norm, and taken that out of context. I urge this court not to follow the other appellate courts, but to follow our Illinois Supreme Court's clear edict from People v. Neal. And understanding that I am out of time, unless there are any other questions, I will simply ask this court to find that his restoration hearing was inadequate, remand his case for a new trial, or in the alternative, to remand for a new trial with counsel. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel. You'll have opportunity to address this again in rebuttal. Mr. Getten?
Hear me okay, Your Honors?
May it please the court.
May it please the court. My name is Connor Getten. I represent the state counsel.
You have to speak up a little bit, counsel.
Sorry, can you hear me now?
Better.
Okay. Thank you, Your Honor. So first, I would like to address defendant's ability to proceed pro se. In this case, it has never been a question of whether or not defendant's mental illness prevents him from understanding court proceedings or information he is taking in or anything of the sort. His counsel conceded that at the restoration of fitness hearing. Dr. Killian said that there is no question of his cognitive understanding. Defendant was able to hear and understand the 404 admonishments he was given. He was given the other admonishments that are strongly suggested by the case law that I'm blanking on the name of right now.
Ward.
The Ward admonishments. He was given a copy of those Ward admonishments to review and read over in between hearings. So I don't think it's a question of whether or not he had the capacity to to proceed pro se, excuse me, Your Honors. Further, the letter that he sent was just a common or a misunderstanding of potentially whose role it is to enter a guilty plea. A lack of legal knowledge, I'm sorry, Your Honors, does not prevent someone from waiving their right to counsel. Per Hood, which I cited in my brief. So I think that defendants had the capacity to make a knowing and voluntary waiver of counsel and did so. Proceeding to the whether or not defendant was fit.
Let's put this
with respect to that. Excuse me, Justice Doherty.
Go back
to a question Justice Doherty asked opposing counsel, and that had to do with the standard of review. In your brief, you do agree with opposing counsel that the standard of review that we should use is abuse of discretion. Why isn't manifest weight of the evidence appropriate here?
I'm having trouble answering that question at the moment, Your Honor. If you would like me to do some supplemental briefing on the question.
We have Supreme Court case law. I don't think we need supplemental briefing, but our Supreme Court case law, as Justice Doherty pointed out, indicates that in fitness hearings, it's manifest weight of the evidence, except as opposing counsel indicated, the focus here is perhaps how the hearing, at least according to opposing counsel, was conducted. Do you agree with that being our focus here?
No, Your Honor.
The evidence or sufficiency of the evidence?
No, Your Honor. I believe that I apologize if this is not answering your question exactly, but I believe that the hearing conducted was adequate based on the evidence that was considered. So I would say that manifest or abuse of discretion is the adequate standard.
Thank you.
So, Mr. Gettin, let's make sure we put this in context. We had a finding of unfitness, right? And we know that the manifestation of the unfitness that doesn't seem to be disputed were these hallucinations. Was a record outside of the, we don't know somebody's hallucinating unless they tell us, right? But we know that there was validation of that in terms of what he told the psychiatrist, in terms of his medical history. And the burden now fell on the state to prove that he was no longer unfit. Is it sufficient to prove he's no longer unfit for just the defendant to say, I'm not having hallucinations, even if it contradicts what he said in other records during the time frame that he said he wasn't hallucinating?
It's not just what the defendant said during your hearing, Your Honor. It's how he conducted himself during the hearing.
But isn't that consistent with the nature of these hallucinations? What he would have said, meaning I'm fit and I don't want to have this attorney represent me. These are things that are consistent with what the agreed hallucinations had been telling him to say earlier.
They are, but I would note that defendant does not always follow the directives that the alien, I don't want to mispronounce the alien's name, so I will just refer to her as the alien, that the alien tells him to do. In his first interview with Dr. Killian, defendant made it very clear that the alien does not want him to tell anyone about her, lest she go away. Despite this fact, defendant told the police about the alien, he told his girlfriend about the alien, he told his counsel, Mr. Piper, about the alien, he told both medical staffs about the alien.
And what is the significance of that?
The significance of that to me is that he does not, Dr. Killian's contention is that he would not listen to or follow the advice of his counsel. He would only follow the advice of the alien, but it shows that defendant has the agency to be able to make his own decisions. And
that kind of works in a circle, right? Because the only way we know what the alien says is what he tells us.
That's correct.
So he could never say anything about the alien under that analysis, right? Because that's the only way he could prove he follows the alien.
I'm sorry, can you restate your question?
I apologize. Sure. I guess we have impeachment about whether he follows the alien or not, but he has said it. It's his words that the alien would tell him to lie about seeing her. And he, in fact, testified, I don't see her. As counsel said, he didn't say, I no longer see her. How does that reassure us that he has had fitness restored?
I think, again, you have to look towards that in itself is not reassuring, but you have to look towards his conduct during the hearing, as well as Dr. Pan's opinion. And I think that that is a sufficient evidentiary basis to satisfy the standard.
But if he had that same conduct during the hearing, meticulously spoke to the court, but also told him, yes, and the alien is talking to me now, how would we feel about fitness? Isn't the latter really the thing?
No, I think the thing is his ability to assist with his counsel. And I think that it's not necessarily just because he hears the alien that he cannot assist with his counsel. I think that further, if we look at his performance at trial, he did an adequate job of not only assisting his counsel, but actually putting on his own defense. He was able to excuse voir dire people. He was able to introduce evidence. He was able to advance a theory that someone else was the murderer in question, which given the circumstances of the case was probably the only theory he could have realistically advanced. Dr. Killian said in the hearing, it's about his functionality. People can be schizophrenic and they can still be fit to stand trial. And I think the evidence at the hearing was sufficient to support that finding.
What about, as counsel said, the denial of his history, of his diagnosis of schizophrenia, of the attribution to his earlier hallucinations as being somehow related to sleep deprivation? Does that give us some concern?
I think it would have been better had he not made those statements, but I don't think those statements in themselves are enough to conclude that he was not able to assist with his defense. I believe, unless there are further questions, is all I have, and I would ask that this court affirm the judgment of the court below. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you.
Well, I guess I do have one other question, and that's regarding a retrospective fitness hearing versus a new trial. Why is a retrospective fitness hearing appropriate, given the fact that we're not focused on a strictly medication and that we're 2.5 years out?
I believe that question still, that given, oh, I'm sorry, I'm blanking on the case that was cited, opposing counsel.
Neil
prescribes that a restorative fitness hearing, it can still be ordered even after the length of time, or regardless of the amount of time that has passed.
Well, but I believe there, if I'm not mistaken, that was focused only on the issue of medication. Isn't there a narrow group of cases, of situations where it is appropriate to hold a retrospective fitness hearing, even if we're more than a year out?
I believe there is, but I apologize. I would need to look back on my notes. I apologize.
That's okay, counsel. Thank you. I don't have any further questions.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you, Justice Zeno. Thank you, counsel. And we'll let Ms. Lucy now have her rebuttal argument.
Thank you, Your Honor. Briefly to the second argument that I made, the state has argued that there was not a problem of cognitive understanding here What I would say here is, and the state also argued that there was a common misunderstanding that Dustin had about his right to plead guilty or not guilty. What I would point out is that we don't know, because the trial court did not make a record in this case about Dustin's ability, not just to understand the words of the admonishment, but to fully comprehend the actual consequences and what it all is going on. We just don't have that in the record, which, given that this is such a due process fundamental concept, is deeply problematic. Indeed, in Indiana v. Edwards, which admittedly is, you know, did give the state's discretion, the Supreme Court noted that mental illness is not a unitary concept, that it varies in degree. And so the fact that Dustin was able to then somewhat put on a somewhat cogent defense later really doesn't apply when the question is, was due process comported with at this hearing? And in both hearings, the answer is no.
Counsel, I have a question for you about the fitness hearing. If my understanding is correct, at the fitness hearing, the court received the initial report of Dr. Killian about the defendant being unfit, which led to his finding that he was unfit for trial and commitment to HHS. So I have that report. And then in addition, the court also received the reports from Dr. Casey and Dr. Pam regarding the defendant by stipulation. Then in addition, the court heard from Dr. Killian's testimony in court, which also, as Justice Doherty pointed out, was when Dr. Killian was present to hear the defendant testify, and not only was able to testify generally, but added his assessment of the defendant based upon watching the defendant testify. And in addition, the court, as Justice Doherty pointed out, asked Dr. Killian several questions himself. And last, the court heard from the defendant and received his testimony concerning this question. And after all that, made a determination that the defendant was fit to stand trial, his fitness had been restored. That isn't the question for us that you're arguing on appeal, one where we would have to conclude to reverse that determination that this ruling by the trial court was unreasonable, that no reasonable person in the position of the trial court, having received and heard all of this evidence, could have concluded that the defendant was now fit to stand trial?
Your Honor, I believe that this court would have to conclude, as the First District did in People v. Gibson, that the trial court simply did not make enough findings to reconcile the conflict.
Well, counsel, let me interrupt. That's entirely incorrect. As Justice Doherty pointed out, I think Justice Enoff too, Gibson was a case where there was essentially receiving this by stipulation. The court conducted no hearing. That was the problem in Gibson. In this case, we have extensive evidence being presented, totally unlike Gibson. I'm surprised you would even mention Gibson in this context. The court heard all the evidence I just mentioned, heard Dr. Killian, received the stipulations, heard the defendant, received the early reports. My question is, don't we on review have to conclude that the decision of the trial court was unreasonable, that no reasonable person, having heard all of this, could have concluded that the defendant was now fit to stand trial?
I believe the conclusion that I'm urging this court to find is that the trial court did not use the correct presumption when it stated that I don't know how Dustin could prove that he was fit, rather than precluding the possibility of him being unfit. That's where Gibson comes in. I do understand the differentiation.
But you haven't answered my question, counsel.
I beg your pardon, Your Honor.
My question is essentially a standard review. Don't we have to conclude that no reasonable person, having heard the evidence, that the court did in this case could have concluded that the defendant was fit to stand trial? Isn't that the question before us?
I don't know that this court needs to go so far, but if this court feels that it does, then that's absolutely supported by the record, where Dustin's testimony was filled with blatant falsehoods. Your Honor, I am trying to go as quickly as possible. I did see that my time has elapsed, and I do apologize for taking this court's time. That falls under Isang, where another court found that a defendant merely saying, oh no, I'm fit now, this is okay, makes a mockery of the entire idea of a fitness hearing. So the trial court crediting Dustin's testimony above that of Dr. Killian's without making any sort of determination on why, without giving us a record of why this lie-filled testimony, this report from Dr. Pan, where Dustin had already begun his unraveling of the truth, should be given better weight when the state had to prove by a preponderance of the evidence that he had been restored to fitness, and that simply was not done here. The record does not support that conclusion, Your Honor.
Okay. Thank you, counsel, and thank you, Mr. Gettin. The court will take this matter under advisement and will now stand in recess.